Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. To a Russian handler known as Oleg, Navid Jamali appeared to be a spectacular asset. Easily plied with stacks of crisp $100 bills, Jamali's apparent greed and vanity were enough to drive him to steal and sell American secrets to this Russian, ostensibly in New York to work at the UN. Jamali filled Oleg's orders for sensitive information for 3 years until he helped the FBI make a move to bring Oleg's career in espionage to a grinding permanent halt, despite the fact that he did and does enjoy diplomatic immunity from prosecution. Navid Jamali is a reserve intelligence officer for the U.S. Navy today. He tells the story of how he served his country as a self-selected double agent in his new book, How to Catch a Russian Spy, the true story of an American civilian turned double agent. Navid, welcome to Think.
Hey, thrilled to be here.
This story should dispel any notions that Russian espionage ended with the Cold War. There are still plenty of people working to steal our secrets.
Oh, and then some. Yes, that's the short of it. Yeah, it is the second oldest profession. It will never abate.
Your path into the world of counterintelligence is unlike any other that I have heard of. It started with a weird encounter when you were, like, not even a teenager at your parents' business.
That's right. That's right. It really started with my parents. My father, as the name Navid Jamali implies, we can't trace our lineage to the Mayflower. That's the opening joke. And my parents came to the United States and started a small company that provided research material to the federal government. And what we didn't know at the time was that because they were in New York and they were essentially a federal contractor, that made them an interesting target for the Russians, who decidedly one day walked into their office and asked to buy some books. My father did not know who this man who came in was. He sort of showed him a card very quickly that said Soviet and then had the words UN in there, and wanted to buy some heady academic-type titles on nuclear proliferation and weapons disarmament, but nothing that really raised any concerns. And my father thought that this was an account with the UN and was very happy to expand his business. So when the man left, went back to work, and not more than 10, 15 minutes later, two more men came in. And this time it was the FBI, who said, the man who just came here was Soviet intelligence. What did he want? My father said he wanted to buy some books. And they said, okay. And the short of it is he showed the FBI the list and said, what do you want me to do? And the FBI said, well, get him his books. And so that essentially went on for almost 20 years, where the Soviets and then the Russians, as you said, there was no change between the end of the Cold War, would drop off books, lists for books, then pick up their order, and my parents would then turn over that order to the FBI.
To be clear, the things that the Soviets and then the Russians were requesting were not technically classified. They were just really difficult for anyone without sort of government clearance to obtain. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. But there's an important piece that I think most people don't necessarily pick up on. That is, there's a saying where your enemies may know what information you want, but only your friends know what information you don't have. And in the case of the Russians, they would come in and they were essentially saying, look, we want books on this type of radar system or manufacturing of aluminum. And I'm just making up random titles. And by them telling my parents that these were books and subject areas that they were interested, they were admitting that this was information they didn't know. And that information in the intelligence community is known as an intelligence gap. And that has huge implications and is, of course, of great interest to the intelligence community. So essentially, for almost two decades, this sort of pedestrian bookstore, book reseller, was able to help the intelligence community keep track on what the Soviets and the Russians didn't know. And that has huge value.
Okay, so you're dead.
Yes.
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead,
please.
Sorry. Yes, you're right. They were technically not secret or top secret documents.
Your dad didn't hesitate to assist the FBI when they said we could use you letting us know what these folks want to buy. Did your mom have any objections? Was she worried about danger to the family, to the business, that sort of thing?
You know, a little. I mean, they were both my parents grew up. You know, my mother was born at the close of the Second World War. My father was born and lived through partition between India and Pakistan. So they knew real war and real strife. And when they came to the U.S., they found that this was, became their adopted country. But they were also children of the 60s. So it was definitely a little bit of a moral conundrum for them to decide whether to you know, on one hand, they wanted to help their new country. On the other hand, they didn't really want to go. It was the FBI. And they were, you know, like I said, hippies. So there was this very, very, you know, kind of red line that they drew where they would help the FBI, but not too much. The FBI would say, hey, can we take you out to dinner? My parents would say, no, that's all right. And the same thing with the Russians. They would try to, you know, up the order, and they just status quo. So they weren't really ever scared, I don't think, because it just seemed so, well, pedestrian, if you will.
Okay, so your mom and dad were real go-getters professionally and academically. When you were a kid, let's just say you were less motivated.
Right. I always say that school went. I went to it like oil and water, not like duck to a water. And we very much had a mutual understanding that, you know, it was best if we were separate. So I ended up at NYU through a sort of not a direct path, but I was the sort of counter to my, you know, overachieving academic parents. You know, when my parents, when I told them, you know, hey, the title of the new book, How to Catch a Russian Spy, I mean, they're almost the traditional immigrants. Their response probably would have been, you know, something along the lines of, what, only one Russian spy, you know, Dan Smith down the street got five, and he's also married to a doctor. So, you know, this is kind of, I can't say that I follow completely in their footsteps.
Well, you're married to a PhD, right? So that's good.
Yeah, but not a medical doctor. Yeah.
Okay, so what changed for you on 9/11?
Well, you know, I'm a true New Yorker. There's not many places that Naveed Jamali can sort of fit in and not stick out. And one of those places for me is always New York. And I was working prior to 9/11. I was working in technology and worked, you know, it was reasonably successful, but just felt something was missing. And certainly after 9/11, seeing New York attacked, which, you know, for me was just this center of everything that was diverse and just, it was my home. I felt like I had to do something that had meaning. And working at a university, and while there's nothing wrong with that, and, you know, kind of, it just didn't have any higher purpose for me. So I tried to get into the Navy in this intelligence program and, you know, put my heart and soul into it and was not selected. And that was the beginning of, oddly enough, the path that led me to become a double agent.
So it occurred to you that you could serve your country almost literally in your backyard, or at least in your parents' store.
Sure.
What was your idea?
Simply put, I thought that when I didn't get into the Navy, I had this wonderful salt of the earth recruiter, Lino Covarrubias from Quincy, Massachusetts, who said to me, Naveed, if this is something you really, really want, you know, it might take 2-3 times. Don't give up. And if you want to go back, you know, the only requirement the Navy has is that when you apply again, there's something different on your resume. And as you mentioned before, school and I didn't go all that great together. And I'd applied and gotten into a graduate program, but really didn't like it. So I had this bright idea that taking over the quote-unquote family account with the Russians, that I approached the FBI and said, look, I'd like to help you. Maybe I can push things a little further. But in exchange, do you think you could write me a letter of recommendation for this program with the Navy? And that was the innocent foray that led me into this whole world.
What was their initial response?
They were very withholding. that's sort of how – it's almost like having a second set of parents. Mm-hmm. You know, it's always a mind trip. And they looked at me and they said, you know, something very neutral along the lines of, yeah, I think we can probably help with that. I guess that the minute they got to the car, they were probably like, oh, geez, great. We've got a live one and we don't have to get him out of jail. You know, there's no problems with the taxes. He just wants a letter of recommendation. How easy is that?
Okay, so what were the rules about the money that you would receive from the Russians in compensation for information you provided for them?
Well, you know, this was a foreign intelligence service, so I couldn't take the money and put it in my pocket. So I would give it to the FBI, and I think one of the minor notes, but one of the things that I'm most proud of, is that the Russians essentially for over 3 years funded the operation against them with their own money. So we would take the money from the FBI. And look, I want to be clear. I wasn't doing this for money. I really was doing this to get into the Navy. And then the FBI would take it and then eventually, you know, at some point would give it back to me, which was all very uncomfortable. But yeah, I mean, the money would go technically back to the FBI.
Okay, so tell us about Oleg, who was your Russian handler. What did it take for you to give him the impression that you would be open to the idea of getting him more information than you had in the past, if the price was right?
So Oleg, you know, as I found out much later, you know, just reading about diplomats and the whole Russian and Soviet spy games that go on in the States, to come to the U.S., especially New York or D.C., but I think New York especially, you have to be pretty good at what you do. And Oleg was no exception to that. He was very, you know, he was a senior officer in the Russian military, and he was a skilled interrogator. I mean, when I met with him, it was, make no mistake, it was him interrogating me and looking for any signs of deception or compromise. And that's really, you know, they could, there's only so much that they could look into and surveil me, that they had to make a judgment based on how I acted as to whether I was legitimate or not. But even before that, I had to sort of rope him in. And look, the foreign intelligence agencies do this day after day. They go abroad to recruit spies. They're not – that's what their job is. Every single one of them, they're there to knock on doors, find people who are willing and willing to help and have access to information. So I had access to Oleg through, you know, this sort of 20-year relationship. But the Russians just looked at this as a small, you know, account. And it was a challenge to try to convince him to move things forward and to do it on his terms, because they weren't interested in – me sort of driving the bus. It had to all come from them. And it was a lot of work. It was a lot of planning and a little bit of luck, I guess.
Do you think the fact that your parents were not born in the United States convinced the Russians that maybe you would be more likely than most Americans to turn a traitor on your own country?
Of course. I mean, there's no doubt that, look, there's we have profiles for insider threats and for spies here, and they have profiles for people they like to recruit. There's this great acronym that is used in the espionage business, MICE, M-I-C-E, and it's the four pillars of motivation for people that commit espionage. M is for money, I is for ideology, C is for coercion, and E is for ego. And look, I think that the Russians assumed that because I was first-generation American, that you know, this is probably their own cultural bias, that I was less likely to have an attachment to the United States. I mean, they knew I wasn't a sociopath, someone like Hansen, or, you know, detached in that manner. But I mean, their assumption really was that immigrants are less integrated. This is my belief, and less likely to have sort of a strong loyalty to this country.
What did Oleg look like?
He was probably not a very imposing figure, but 5'7", 5'8", very slim and trim. He had a mustache, very, very intense blue eyes. You would look at him and you probably wouldn't think twice about him. But he, you know, he stood ramrod straight and we had this office that overlooked this giant hill. And I guess he wouldn't drive to our parking lot. So I'd watch him go up and down the hill when he would come to meet us, originally in our office. And he would, I mean, he would just fly up that hill. I learned later that he was quite the avid swimmer. So he was in very good shape, but certainly not, you know, not this sort of evil, you know, Dr. No from the James Bond, nothing like that.
No eye patch, no
eye patch,
coat.
No, nothing. No, it was just like 1980s, you know, like Men's Warehouse style. That's what he wore.
My guest is Naveed Jamali, a reserve intelligence officer for the U.S. Navy and former civilian double agent for the FBI. His new book is called How to Catch a Russian Spy, The True Story of an American Civilian Turned Double Agent. You can be part of our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is U.S. Navy Reserve Intelligence Officer Naveed Jamali. His new book is called How to Catch a Russian Spy, the true story of an American civilian turned double agent. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think at kera.org. It turned out, Naveed, to be a pretty big deal to price your requests right. So in other words, when it became clear that Oleg was interested in perhaps further exploiting this relationship he had with you, you had to ask for more money, but you needed to not ask for too much, and yet you needed to make it look like you were motivated by greed.
That's right. That's right. You know, one of the toughest things that I had to do was figure out, what do you charge for committing treason? And apparently there is a matrix for this. There really is. And as you said, on one hand, you can't charge too little because the Russians will look at this and say that this guy is too eager. And look, the easiest thing for them to do is just to walk. And you can't charge too much because the Russians, it shouldn't surprise people, they're a government agency. They have a budget for spies. And, you know, they can only spend that much money. And as I found out with Oleg, that, you know, he was probably given a level of discretionary funding for negotiations. But above that certain point, he had to go and get approval. So it became a challenge to try to figure out, you know, how to price this.
You formed what can only be described as a kind of alter ego in your interactions with him. How did spy Naveed differ from real life Naveed?
Oh, he was kind of a jerk. I mean, that was the easiest way to put it. You know, I couldn't change my name. I couldn't change the car I drove. I couldn't change where I lived or any of my background information. I was naive enough to not think about it. It's funny, Chris, when I finished all this and I talked to a few people, like, well, what name did you use? And I was like, name? I didn't think I should have. I guess I should have asked for one of those. No, I used my real name. And so the short of it is the Russians could check anything, you know, biographical about me. And the one thing they couldn't do was figure out what my personality was. So I created this because I figured it was, you know, my motivation was going to be money and ego. I read a lot of books and watched a lot of movies and literally just took the dialogue from various movies when I met with Oleg to sort of emulate this sort of cocky, arrogant persona that, for whatever reason, the Russians really believed was what a spy should act like.
So did you like – was it like a little Tom Cruise and a little I don't know who did you decide?
Yeah, one of my favorite was Colin Farrell in Miami Vice in Michael Mann's movie. I think it was 2005, 2006 that movie. But yeah, Tom Cruise in Collateral. I mean, I just took these dialogues. Famously, I remember one time when Oleg asked me to sign a receipt. He'd given me some money. He said, "Will you sign a receipt?" And I'm thinking, this is insane. You know, a spy, what? What spy? Yes, can you send a carbon copy to the Department of Justice too, Oleg? That'd be great. So I lifted the dialogue from Miami Vice where there's a scene where the undercover cops are in Haiti with these drug dealers, and the drug dealers accuse them of being police. And their response is to say, well, how do we know you're not the police? And I did that with Oleg. I said, you want me to sign a receipt? How do I know you're not the FBI? Show me your ID. And I made him show me his ID, and he was very – I mean, it was like literally – and I couldn't believe that he did it, but he took out his UN ID, took out his, like, driver's license. And it was all because I lifted that one line from Miami Vice. It worked.
Did you, like, run home and program Netflix so that you could be ready for next time?
I did. I actually, the night before I would meet with him, I'd have this repertoire of movies that I would watch, try to get myself pumped up and to try to capture the flavor of that dialogue.
When you first started doing this, you kept it really to yourself, and it's not the kind of thing you want to go around broadcasting. Your wife found out in a scene that could have ended very badly.
Yes. So, you know, we called it the circle of trust, and that's what the FBI taught me. And it really was this strange world where, you know, on one hand, I'm living in New York. My life is, to the outside, you know, totally the same. But on the other hand, I have this crazy other part of my life that ended up getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And luckily, the FBI was you know, they understood the pressures it puts on people, and they, you know, they they said, if you ever want to tell your wife, just let us know. But yeah, she found out in a very unique way, and not to ruin the book, but I can say, oddly enough, it involved a tampon and another FBI agent. And that's how I had to tell my wife that I was involved in a counterintelligence operation against the Russians. It was a strange, surreal thing. But the fact that normal life bled into this operation and vice versa, it became pretty hard as I started moving down into this to kind of keep those lives, those balls separate, if you will.
What's really strange is that when you finally explain to her, no, there wasn't someone else, and there wasn't, a woman in the apartment that I'm interested in. This is the deal. I mean, that sounds, no, I'm working for the FBI to help catch a Russian spy. It sounds like the worst lie in the history of philandering husbands.
It is, right. So maybe I'll give a little bit of background. My wife came home. I met with the FBI, and one of the agents left a tampon wrapper in the when she used my bathroom. And my wife had no idea that I had a meeting. So when she came home, she said, "Do you have anyone in the apartment today?" And I was like, "No." And so eventually, she showed me the wrapper, and I'm thinking, well, what are my options here? I can either – I mean, none of them are good because none of them sound believable. Either you're having an affair or right. Really, Naveed, you're involved in a counterintelligence operation. You met with the FBI. And the latter one, of course, was true. So it became, and then her reaction, of course, was, well, did you clean the apartment? And, it was just, as I said, Chris, it just became harder and harder to keep these worlds separate. But I was lucky enough that, my wife was very tolerant and, kind of kept me grounded in the normal world, if you will.
How smooth were you as a spy?
That's a tough one. We had moments that were, literally lifted from Hollywood movies. But then there are other moments where, I'm slamming a trunk on the Russian's head, almost killing him. So I don't know.
Accidentally, we should say.
I'll put air quotes. Accidentally, right? I don't know. All I can go back to is, for whatever reason, everything just kind of worked. Whether it was smooth or not smooth, and it just – everything put together, just the Russians believed it.
I have to ask about this because clearly you had your mission in mind. You really wanted to protect your country, and you wanted to facilitate this operation by the FBI. At the same time, Oleg was a guy you got to know over a matter of years. You had meals with him. Did it feel strange sometimes knowing, even though I suppose he assumed he was using you, you knew him and you knew that you were essentially an instrument in his demise?
I have a lot of respect for Oleg. As I said, it's you have to be really good to be a Russian intelligence officer and come to the United States. You also have to be – it's a game. And he knew the rules, and I assume that everyone who comes here knows the rules. But there was another thing, and that was there was a cultural and age gap barrier. I was in my late 20s. He was in his mid 40s. He was a, late Soviet era Russian military intelligence officer who'd we never really jived. Now, mm-hmm. I didn't dislike him. I still don't dislike him. I feel, he's not like ISIS or this is a guy who was a patriot and doing his duty as a military officer, and I have no fault for that. It still doesn't mean he didn't lose. But for whatever reason, I never connected with him. And part of that was a mechanism to kind of compartmentalize this and do what I was doing.
I would think that when you were meeting off-site away from the store that your parents started, that I guess I would picture you in a dark alley somewhere, or I would picture you in the lobby of a swanky hotel. Oleg liked pizza joints and Hooters.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to, I was hoping the State Department write a complaint to the Russians that when they take their spies out to lunch, they could perhaps up their budget a little bit. But no, the Russians, it is a kind of a running joke, but there's a little bit of a darker side to it. And I'll start with the joke part first. Yes, the Russians, and I couldn't figure out, was it because it was a caricature of a caricature? Like, is this what they thought I liked? But yeah, they would take these sort of chain restaurants, not there's anything wrong with them, one of which turned out to be Hooters, and the closing scene with Oleg actually takes place at a Hooters in Wayne, New Jersey, of all places. And I mean, you can't – it was just this surreal stuff that you're in these, kind of middle-of-the-road, middle-of-America type chain restaurants and you're sitting with a Russian spy. So that was strange. Now, the sinister part is, again, the Russians were very skilled at what they did, and I have no doubt that they chose those locations in part because there was, you know, serious surveillance and counter-surveillance they employed, and probably the location close to, you know, freeways and things like that was probably more important than the dining fare.
So are you saying you think you maybe weren't alone when you would meet in a particular place?
You know, God bless the FBI. They would I would always ask them questions like, you know, does Oleg have a gun? And they're like, well, probably not. And I was like, what is that? Is that a yes or a no? It's not really very reassuring. But yeah, there were times that I would go, you know, I would meeting with Oleg, I'd go to the bathroom and someone would sort of kind of come rushing in after me, and I couldn't tell if they were – it felt wrong, but, you know, you couldn't tell if they were, you know, watching me or if they just had to go to the bathroom. And this kind of went on, and that was sort of the world that I ended up living in, is that, you know, you'd see a black van with tinted windows. Is it just a black van with tinted windows, or is there something more sinister? And the thing that you have to resign yourself when you live this world is that you just don't know. You have to trust your instincts, but there's just so much that you have no idea, and, you know, it's just the way it is. So I would assume that they'd be silly not to keep tabs on me, but I never knew definitively if they did.
Does it make you paranoid after a while? Are you just, you know, like going for a run, or you're at the grocery store and suddenly you start to look around and wonder?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I still do. I mean, it becomes this – look, it's sort of like – oh, you're being paranoid. But then again, you're in a counterintelligence operation with the Russians. So your standard of what is crazy and what isn't, I guess, gets shifted slightly.
There was a point at which you were sort of painted into a corner, not necessarily by any fault of your own, and you had to give up some information that the FBI had not meant for you to turn over.
Yeah, I mean, that's – you know, the biggest fear I had is at some point there was a change in me, and that change went from I really wanted to get into the Navy, very much so, and at a certain point I started to really enjoy what I was doing. It was a rush. I can't deny that it wasn't fun to sit down and sort of had this sort of mental battle with Oleg. And it became – what I started to get really concerned about was that the FBI would pull the plug or something would happen that the operation would end before we could have some sort of satisfying conclusion. And as things progressed, you know, the information we were trading, the risks, everything started to grow. And I – for so many years, I had no sense of sort of the enormous agency, the FBI that was behind this. It was really me and two agents that would sit around and just like Oleg in coffee shops, and not Hooters, but and you know, try to discuss how to do this. And there was one point where we were looking at a database, a system that I had access to, and Oleg asked for a file, and I had to make a snap decision as to whether to give it to him or not, and it hadn't been cleared. And this sort of innocuous decision in the heat of the moment, you know, had massive ramifications that essentially almost caused the operation to get pulled.
And the deal was you had tried to put him off and say, oh, well, I don't have a printer right here. And he hands you a thumb drive and says, just download it.
What are the chances? Yeah, we'd planned everything. We're like, we're going to meet in the car. There's no printer. There's no CD drive. So if he – and this is, you know, and circa 2007, 2008. So it's – you know, computers are – it was a little different back then. But we were online, and we – you know, I'd assured the FBI there was no way that he could get a file. And we had no – what are the chances that he's going to show up with a thumb drive I'd given him at the last meeting to give back to me? And he looks – and he asked, can I have that file? And I was all prepared. Oh, well, there's no way for me to print it. And he said – and he paused and he looked at me. And he said, well, what about this? And he reached into his pocket and takes out this thumb drive I'd given him, you know, 4 or 5 months ago. And, you know, at that point, what could I say? I couldn't say – there was no legitimate reason I could give him to not copy it. So, yeah, they were not – that was the one time that I saw how quickly the FBI – could, you know, your favorite son status could change very, very quickly.
What was it like? Because you had to go home basically and call them and tell them, okay, this just happened.
I remember it very clearly. We were at the Hotel Marrakesh on Broadway and like 100th in New York City. And I call, you know, we'd have this whole protocol when I'd leave, I drive, I'd, you know, tell them I was clear. And, you know, your adrenaline's going and I'm driving in a way that you would drive and you would stop and make sure no one's following you. So there's this whole way, then I'd park, and it's a whole sort of method to, you know, before I meet with them. So I'd met with them and, you know, I'd asked if they could bring a couple of beers. And it was kind of this very – I knew that I had messed up. I knew that they were – I knew this was going to be a big deal. I didn't have a sense until I told them. And they sort of – there was a pause and they said to me, you know, well, at least the Russians aren't going to think it's not real now. But they were – yeah, it became – you know, that was the bureaucracy of things. And luckily my whole operation, I was completely shielded from that. I was kind of this kid who was treated like – this was a startup. I was sort of given this creative freedom to solve this how I saw fit. And that was the one time that I saw that, hey, you know, the reality is that the government can't just do whatever they want.
How much did you try to pay attention to the content of the information you were giving Oleg? I mean, a lot of it without context wouldn't make a lot of sense to a civilian. Did you even care what you were giving him?
Sure. I mean, that's a great point. So, look, at the end of the day, the Russians weren't investing in the information I was giving them. It had benefit to them. I won't deny that. But what they were investing in was me. They wanted a long-term asset. Having, you know, building a relationship and getting a spy and having that person set up, that's not an easy thing to come by. These are really – human assets are the crown jewels of any intelligence agency, any intelligence service. So they were very interested in me. They wanted me to be a source that would work 5, 10, 15, 20 years for them. So a lot of the information that I passed them, the context of the information enclosed was important. But what was more important was how I got it. So the Russians, as I said, Oleg was a skilled interrogator. And you have to understand that I would give him information. It would go back to Moscow. And months later, he would meet with me. And they would have follow-up questions to see, again, to just see if there was any signs of deception. You know, what form did you use? Who was your sponsor? I mean, they were very, very well versed in sort of the protocols and methods to get this stuff, you know, and you had to be ready. So that's the other part of this was essentially building a reason to have access to this stuff.
My guest is Naveed Jamali, a reserve intelligence officer for the U.S. Navy and former civilian double agent for the FBI. His new book is called How to Catch a Russian Spy, the true story of an American civilian turned double agent. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Naveed Jamali. He is a reserve intelligence officer for the U.S. Navy and former civilian double agent for the FBI. His book is called How to Catch a Russian Spy, the true story of an American civilian turned double agent. Naveed, it must have occurred to you over the course of these years that while you saw them as the good guys and you developed a really great, cordial relationship, the FBI was playing you as an asset as well.
Of course. You know, you're stuck between these two monolithic organizations. But yeah, very much so. I was useful to them as long as I was useful to them.
Were there times when you thought, I wonder if they're manipulating me?
Oh, my goodness. Every time I met with them, they knew. I mean, it was – that's it. You know, it's funny. The CIA in the intelligence community, the term manipulation is actually a very positive one in the sense that, you know, it doesn't have your motivation if you're trying to manipulate someone to do something bad. That's not a good thing. But, yeah, that's it. They were trying to get me – they needed me to be in place in order to get to the Russians.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Wade in Fort Worth. Hi, Wade.
Hello, how are y'all?
Great, thanks.
First of all, thank you for your service to our country.
Oh, and, my honor.
Well, good. I'm a Navy veteran. I have a son in the Navy now. He's also in the intelligence world. I just wanted to ask you, are you now or were you ever concerned for your safety, especially now writing the book and being on the radio about your experiences?
You know, it's a good question. It's a fair one. The short answer is no. You know, the Russians, they're a professional military intelligence service, and again, it's not terrorists. This is sort of a gentleman's game, and you know, they won this round, or we won this round rather, and they'll win the next one. It just kind of goes on and on. So the short of it is no. I don't think that there's any benefit for them to come after me.
We have an email question here from Lindsley, who wants to know, what was your plan if your Russian handler ever started asking you pointed questions about whether you were really working for the U.S.?
My plan? I don't think I ever thought that far in advance, but I think it's nice that they gave me that credit. You know, I found that when the Russians pushed me, the best thing to do was to push back. And, you know, if you're a real spy, you're under a tremendous amount of stress, and I think the Russians understood that too. I mean, they were trying to manipulate me and handle me in a certain way. And there were times where the Russians, you know, tried to push me. And the minute I pushed back after some heated arguments, they kind of relented. And I think that's the strategy that worked best.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Scott in Fort Worth. Hi, Scott.
Hi. Now that you've written a book and you're definitely, I would think, ineffective as an espionage agent now that you're outed,
sure,
so to speak. I'm just curious, what's next? Because it seems like you have some skills, proven skills, like being able to not have a connection with Oleg, yet he certainly seems to have a connection with you. Are you considering writing more books from this perspective or even acting?
The acting thing I've never considered, but look, there's... I'm happy to announce that you know, the book has been purchased by Fox to become a movie, and Mark Webb, who did Spider-Man, is the director, and Mark Heyman, who's done The Wrestler and Black Swan, is doing the screenplay. So hopefully it'll make it to the big screen. For me, I spend a lot of time and I'm still very passionate about you know, catching spies. And you know, I think that they're, as a result of Snowden and Manning, it's still a very, very, you know, we look at the OPM hack. It's still a very real thing going on. And technology is great, but in the end, people are really what are our biggest threat in the regards of espionage.
I hope you'll forgive my ignorance, but how does a reserve function work when you, how does an intelligence function work when you are a reserve officer for the U.S. Navy?
It's a good question. So I'm a reservist, which means that, you know, you do your traditional 1 weekend a month, 2 weeks a year, except when you don't. So you support various missions, and I probably shouldn't get into those. But, you know, the funny story I will tell you is that when I joined the Navy, and I was thinking, oh, great, I'm going to do the exact same thing that I did as a civilian in the military. And I showed up to my first command and I said, I'm here. And they didn't know who I was. And they said, great, you can plan out the Christmas party. So that was my first duty. But that's just kind of the way it works. You know, you get to do a little bit of everything, I suppose.
We have an email here from Dave who wants to know, what gave them, and I'm assuming he means the Russians, the confidence that they had turned you, and what were they holding over you so you wouldn't report them?
It's a great question. So, look, what gave them the confidence was me convincing Oleg that I was a real spy. It's as simple as that, although that was a heck of an effort. I wasn't communicating directly with Moscow, so I was reliant on him to bring back to Moscow that, look, this is someone that they should invest their limited time and treasure on. Insofar as holding over me, the coercion part. Look, I feel very strongly about this. Coercion is never a good tool for a long-term relationship. It doesn't matter whether it's espionage or professional or personal. It just doesn't work. So the Russians focused on me wanting to do this, that me helping them was benefiting was a benefit to me.
You are, of course, dealing in this case with real people, and that's something that often gets lost when you see TV or movie depictions of this sort of thing.
Sure.
Oleg was super cheap, and he would like try to talk you out of free merchandise, right, when he would visit the store.
Yeah. He was, you know, I mean, the Russians, it was almost comical, but yeah, it was, they had a very odd way of negotiating. And you know, you'd start off and I'd say, it's $25,000. He'd say, it's $3,000. Say, 25, 10. He'd say, no, okay, 10, 25, no, 15, no, 25. Okay, 25. I'm like, well, then why'd you start with 3? So I don't know exactly where they came with their method. But Yeah, I got the feeling that you know, they every dollar, every nickel, every dime had to be accounted for by the Russians. And yeah, they would come into our business, which again, it wasn't a bookstore. It was more of a, you know, we dealt with the governments. We didn't have walk-ins. And he would come and we'd get, you know, we'd have this nice wall in the seating area, and he would start taking free books and just open his trench coat, take out a giant garbage bag and start shoveling them in.
Is there like a physiological reaction the first time somebody hands you, I don't know, like a backpack stuffed with stacks of $100 bills?
It was really just envelopes. You know, it was odd. It was, I created this character of being so fixated on money that, you know, I would probably say something, I hope it's all here, you know, and invariably the Russians would do something like, oh, this is, we're going to give you half now and we'll give you half later, which would, you know, evoke a tirade by me of saying, what do you mean? You're not going to pay me the whole thing. I didn't give you half of the information. So but at the end you had this feeling that, okay, now we're really in business. They're spending money. And look, money means they're serious.
How did you feel when the FBI said, okay, it's time to stop this thing?
Oh, I was devastated. I really was. It was – I couldn't understand, and I found out later why, but I couldn't understand exactly why they wanted to pull the plug. I mean, we were about to join the military. You know, this would have been a great operation to feed the – I was a trusted source by the Russians. I could have fed them disinformation for years, which is, you know, a huge benefit. And it was just this – it just felt like we were at this peak, and to kind of pull the plug just felt, you know – It was personally and professionally sort of like this sort of devastating feeling. But, you know, that's just the way it is.
We won't tell exactly how it happened. But the point was you didn't need to have Oleg go to jail in handcuffs. He just needed to see you essentially see what looked like you getting caught.
That's right. And look, again, the Russians, they are very good at what they do. This is a professional military intelligence agency. And when this operation ended, I imagine that their reaction was, uh-oh, like what has been compromised? And that means, my assumption again here, is that if you are a professional intelligence agency, what the Russians are, you're going to stop using your sources, your safe houses, whatever it might be, until you can go through each one of them and figure out where the compromise was. Now, they couldn't assume that my was the compromise. It could have been anywhere else. It could have been Oleg himself. So I like to think that that had a pretty big impact on Russian intelligence efforts, gathering efforts in the United States.
Back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Elizabeth in Fort Worth. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. This may be a silly question, but if you've ever watched the television show The Americans, I was just curious how realistic it is in your opinion.
Yeah, I certainly it's a great show. You know, I was dealing – the Americans are sort of based on – there's two sort of intelligence sort of units that operate in the United States. There's the SVR, which is more like the CIA, and the GRU, which is the DOD equivalent of military intelligence. And I was dealing with Oleg, who was a name – that is to say, Oleg is his real name. He was a diplomat here. So look, there was no gunfights. There was no murder or anything like that. There was a lot of PowerPoint, which might come as a disappointment to people. So it wasn't quite as glamorous as the Americans, but there were definitely some pretty tense and scary moments.
There was never a self-destructing tape recorder either, right?
No. At least I don't know. Maybe the FBI planted one on me. I don't know. But no, not that I'm aware of.
They did give you a cool device long before the Apple Watch was a thing.
That's right. Now you think about it, and it's like, wow, you realize the Fitbit and the Apple Watch are probably could replace this in a heartbeat. But yeah, they gave me this watch that was a recording device. And to me, it looked like the biggest – it was a G-Shock watch, which is, you know, one of those watches you would see on like a SWAT team or a SEAL.
With the Velcro.
Yeah, exactly. Black and this huge – and to me, it looked like something Flavor Flav would carry on his neck. Like it was just this massive, massive watch. And I was sure that it was so big that the Russians would notice it, and they didn't. But that was the device that I would use to record them.
You knew you had really made it when you were given an FBI code name, even if you didn't like the code name.
Yeah, so you reach a certain point, and they don't want you to use your real name, and the FBI agents were very proud and happy to tell me that they'd give me a code name, and I was all excited, and they told me it was Green Kryptonite. And I you know, for me, my reaction was, what, My Little Pony was taken? You know, there was I was hoping for something a little, you know, a little cooler, like Silver Surfer, you know, something. And it, you know, but when I left, I was kind of like, wow, that's actually kind of neat that I have an FBI code name. It was so neat, in fact, that I decided that it would be a really good idea to get green kryptonite tattooed on my forearm in Morse code, which I did, which meant that when I met with Oleg, I had to wear a lot of long sleeve shirts.
And you didn't want to tell the FBI that you'd done this either, right? Because it's kind of not
a good
idea.
Of course not. I had some sense that if they probably – and when I told them afterwards, they were like – they you know, they shook their head. They weren't that – you live this world, you kind of go a little crazy, and guilty as charged.
What did – when this was finally all over and you were debriefing not just the agents that you had worked with but others, what – were you surprised by the things they wanted to know from you, like things that you thought, I would expect you to understand this already?
You know what? A lot of the questions they got that I got from them were not unlike the questions we've gotten today. I mean, they would the Americans wasn't on, but they I'm sure today when I go and talk about this, people wouldn't be surprised to hear that FBI or counterintelligence agents are like, "Have you seen the show The Americans? What do you think of that?" And it's the same thing. And I realized, oddly enough, that in the counterintelligence world, most of these people never get to deal with the people they watch. They watch them from afar. So in this weird mix, I ended up having more FaceTime with a Russian spy than people who have, you know, 15, 20 years in the FBI.
Hmm. Is it safe to assume there are lots more Olegs out there from multiple countries than most Americans realize?
Yes. it's absolutely safe to, you know, like I said, espionage is the second oldest profession. It's not going to slow down. Why would it? It's the most cost-effective and surefire way to get information.
And of course, we're doing it too.
Of course. It's not, you know, espionage is not this, it's not a moral thing. It's you're trying to gather information and intelligence on your adversaries. And adversaries can be, you know, pretty much anyone, as we've seen. And that's what you're going to do. And you're going to use whatever methods and sources you can.
If you could go back and change anything about the course of your time working with Oleg, is there anything you would do differently?
Oh, that's a tough one. You know, I don't know. I don't think that there was really too much I could have changed. I mean, it was I kind of wish I had taken a picture of him so I could, you know, I had some sort of memory. I mean, I sort of, you know, I kind of have a sense of what he looks like. But other than that, it was, you know, it was so protracted, but also just these real moments of intensity that it was hard to sort of think beyond that. And I can't really think of what I would change, to be honest with you.
Naveed Jamali is a reserve intelligence officer for the U.S. Navy and former civilian double agent for the FBI. His new book is called How to Catch a Russian Spy, The True Story of an American Civilian Turned Double Agent. Naveed, it's been a really interesting conversation. I really appreciate you making time for us.
Thanks, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.